books of prophecy about future politics are often lumped into the futuristic fable category and sometimes dismissed. But we're about to hear from a woman who's a literature scholar who specifically went back to writers from the past who imagined an America that bore some eerie resemblances, she felt, to the present day. For instance, in 1938, a New York Times reporter warned, and I'm quoting, "When and if fascism comes to America, it will not be labelled made in Germany. It will not be marked with a swastika. It will not even be called fascism. It will be called, of course, Americanism." Now, whatever your view is, one thing is certainly underway. Millions of Americans and those beyond, as we've just heard, are trying to discern what is the true nature of current developments in the United States. Can literature help? Well, people are voting with their feet to some extent. George Orwell's 1984, Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, and Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism are all apparently back on the top reading lists as people search for answers and solutions. Sarah Churchwell is a professorial fellow in American literature and chair of public understanding of the humanities at the University of London School of Advanced Study. She's mined her own area of interest for a clever article for a recent Guardian, and I'll ask her to tell us more. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
Your thesis, which is what was so fresh, we thought, was to examine literary tales to offer explanations about the situation that you're in, and possible remedies, I might add. What possessed you to do that?
Well, it was actually sort of a follow-up to a piece that I had written immediately after the election about the fictions that imagined a female president, looking at what we could learn from what the novels, starting in the late 19th century, had said about what a woman president would look like and the way that they actually predicted the way that Hillary was treated in the press. So what you see is the emergence of certain kinds of tropes and patterns in the themes and the metaphors that they use to imagine a female president. So one of the things I said, for example, is that the phrase "crooked Hillary" that, you know, that they attached to her is very uncannily kind of predicted in these novels, because the idea of illegitimacy is always associated with a woman president. So I had been working on that, and then Trump won. So we thought that was going to be a kind of tongue-in-cheek piece that would be a little bit facetious, and then he won, and I ended up rewriting it the day after the election, and then went back to the editor and said, you know what, let's do the same thing about fascism, because I know the stories are there, and I already knew the books, I knew these films, I grew up watching these films as well. So I'd been thinking about them anyway, and then when you go back and you look at some of the things that they said in America during the rise of European fascism were terrifyingly apt. I mean, they could have been written today. It was as if, you know, Steve Bannon had been going through old copies of the New York Times and old novels to work out his plan of attack.
Yes. I mean, the premise of your article is that, you know, some people are saying the election of Donald Trump as president is unimaginable. But the truth is, people have imagined the environment or the forces that brought him to power, haven't they? Or versions of them. Is it that we stopped listening, or when did you first start to realize the parallels with the writers that you are quoting?
Well, I think they were always sort of echoing in my head, and it was only, you know, as he emerged, you know, as we learned more about him, the novel that first came to mind, which other people are mentioning in the context of Trump, is this novel by Sinclair Lewis that was written in 1935 called It Can't Happen Here. And which, of course, is the phrase that America likes to use, has always used, this idea that because America is so exceptional, that its democracy is so robust, that it was somehow insulated, it was somehow protected from fascism. And in the 30s, Lewis was really angry at the complacency of that. And so he imagined how it would happen in America. And again, it looks an awful, I mean, a lot of what is said in the novel, you know, could be written about Trump. He says that it was government of the prophet, by the prophet, for the prophet. And that's the aspect of American fascism that I think is really important, is that it has such a corporate tinge to it, that it's about profiteering. It's, some people say, Sinclair Lewis said in this novel. He actually didn't, but it's a, nobody really knows who said it, but there's this famous line that when fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross.
Mm.
And as I was reading these, you know, rereading these novels, I was thinking, well, it will also have a dollar bill.
Yes.
That's the thing. It's religion, it's patriotism, and then it's about saying that this will all be about everybody getting rich. In Lewis's novel, there's this senator who's a populist, he's a demagogue, he's giving these rabble-rousing speeches, and what he does is he tells everybody that they should get rich by voting to be rich.
Yes.
You know, Lewis is really angry at the kind of empty promises and the fatuity, the folly of the American voters who think that they can just, you know, wish themselves into a better situation. And of course, again, we see that with the people who voted for Trump, as if he's going to be able to bring these factory jobs back, as if he's going to reverse automation, as if he's going to reverse, you know, globalization.
Yes, it is very interesting. You look at fictional writers, but you also look at speeches and comments made, including the Vice President, Henry Wallace, quoted in a 1944 article called American Fascism, quotes, "A fascist whose lust for money or power is combined with such intensity of intolerance towards those of other races, parties, classes, religions, cultures, regions or nations, as to make him ruthless in his use of deceit or violence to attain his ends." Which is a pretty devastating old quote. But you don't think Trump is a fascist, though, do you, really?
No, I actually think he is.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I do. I think he is because that description is a very good description of one. I actually think that Trump is a fascist, and in the strict sense of the term, he is a lot more like Mussolini than he is like Hitler. Mm-hmm. And there's a really interesting article that Umberto Eco wrote, you know, the Italian writer, about 10, 15 years ago in the New York Review of Books, where he talks about the nature of Italian fascism under Mussolini. And he talks about its corporate nature. He calls it fuzzy fascism. And he kind of has this checklist of the aspects of fascism that for him characterized Italian fascism. And you can look at that checklist and reading through it and going, yep, tick, 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 tick. So I don't think Trump is like Hitler, but I think he has a lot in common with Mussolini.
Or Berlusconi, I think, is another very interesting comparison, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's that element of kleptocracy. There's that element of corruption. He's authoritarian, and he clearly has no interest in or respect for democracy or the democratic process. He thinks that anybody who disagrees with him isn't a real voter. He thinks that anybody who disagrees with him should be in jail. And that is, again, a pretty good litmus test for a fascist, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me just tell listeners that Sarah Churchwell is my guest. She has written a very interesting article in The Guardian looking back at literature for its effort to prophesy some of the conditions in the US that might have produced a President Trump. Interestingly, there's been quite a bit of discussion of recent times using interesting American commentators like David Brooks and others. And I noticed that, in fact, there's a very big article by Der Spiegel journalists who've come out, German journalists who've looked at this Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller as people who, deeper than just sort of a discussion about current politics, a real sense of worrying about the state of the Judeo-Christian ethic in the US among the cosmopolitan elites, and actually aligning with elements of sort of purity and orthodoxy in Russia. Very interesting, quite extraordinary sort of verdicts being passed on Stephen Bannon and his verdict on the US. Now, can you see that deeper strand running through any of the literature that you've examined?
Well, that's probably not as apparent in the literature, because they were really talking about European fascism at the time. But what they did recognize, I think, is that affinity that you're talking about is what I would describe as a fundamentalist affinity. It's a kind of evangelical aspect of, you know, certain parts of America, obviously the more rural areas, the more rural voters that did support Trump. And I think it's where we see things that people say that a fundamentalist Muslim or a fundamentalist Jew or a fundamentalist Christian actually all have more in common with each other than they do with secularists. than they do.
Or with an, even with a nationalism, as a, you know, currently defined nationalism.
Indeed. And so it's when you add that, and I mentioned earlier that, you know, the idea of fascism in America has always been recognized as something that would come with a religious caste, that it would have a kind of, you know, a kind of evangelical flavor to it, which is something that a lot of Americans have always responded to. And, you know, the one way to think about America, and something I talk about with my students in London, is that, you know, there really are two founding stories about America, and they're in competition with each other. One is the Mayflower, and that's the Puritans' landing, obviously, but that's a theocratic story. That's the story about the deeply religious coming to America and wanting to create, you know, a religious utopia and a place where they could be, you know, that the Puritan strain would take over. And then when America became independent and became a country in you know, the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and the Constitution in 1789, those are 18th century Enlightenment philosophies from the European philosophers, from Rousseau, from Locke, from Kant. And those are the ideas of the secular humanist, you know, tolerance for others and enlightenment and evidence-based thinking and rationality. And those two foundation stories about America have never been resolved. They're always in conflict with each other. And so, and that to me is the way to characterize the difference between the so-called liberal elite in the cities and the evangelical fundamentalist voters in the, so people say, you know, it's rural, it's city. And I say, well, no, it's two different versions of America. One is theocratic and one is liberal in the 18th century sense of liberal.
It's how interesting. Very interesting characterization. I'd like to read a quote from another writer you examined, Philip Roth, whose 2004 novel, The Plot Against America, has this: to have enslaved America with this hocus-pocus, exclamation mark, to have captured the mind of the world's greatest nation without uttering a single word of truth. Oh, the pleasure we must be affording the most malevolent man on earth. You have a few examples of writers imagining the future where alternative facts, or what we're being told as fake news, sometimes basically outright lying, is at the centre of the rise of the autocrat. Again, you say we shouldn't be surprised.
Well, I think that's right. And that, again, that people recognize that that was how this was always going to work, that propaganda was crucial. And one of the stories that I talk about is actually film, which is one of the lesser-known Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy movies that was called Keeper of the Flame. And that's about Katharine Hepburn's character is married to an American fascist. He's this really popular politician, and then the way the plot unfolds is that gradually it's revealed that he was a secret fascist. And she says that that she found these papers, this whole plot that they had about how they were going to start their fascist movement. And she says what, and this is a movie that was made in 1942. And she says that what they were doing was they were going to plant provocative stories in various newspapers around the country. So they were going to plant anti-Semitic stories in, you know, in the Farmer's Almanac, and they were going to plant, you know, anti-urban stories in, you know, rural areas and whatever. And so, and they line all of those up and say that this is the media is going to be absolutely central to any fascist project.
And the point is, these were a few private individuals, as you write, to whom money didn't mean anything more, but who wanted political power. Gosh, I wonder who that sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Moving on, I mean, Orson Welles' Citizen Kane is, of course, an extraordinary examination. Donald Trump nominated it as his favourite film, so he's obviously watched it. Maybe he's adopting some of Kane's techniques.
He certainly seems to be. He told an interviewer in a documentary a few years ago that Citizen Kane was his favorite movie and that he identified with Charles Foster Kane. He seems to have missed the point that Orson Welles was satirizing Kane and that Kane's story is a tragedy about hubris. and that Kane ends up lonely and miserable because he was chasing all the things that didn't matter. And the cautionary tale aspect of it seems to have been lost on him. And, of course, there's a very famous scene in Citizen Kane. People will know the image where Orson Welles, as Kane, is standing in he's running for governor, and he's standing at a campaign rally in front of a giant picture of himself. And Welles made this movie in 1940, 1941. The war was on, and he was very consciously echoing the iconography of European fascism to suggest that that's where Kane was going. And Trump used exactly that iconography in his acceptance of the Republican National Convention of the nomination. And people were appalled. I mean, people said, why on earth would he set himself up to look like a fascist? And I think it's because I suspect he thought he was echoing Citizen Kane, and may not even know that it was echoing European fascism, although, of course, Steve Bannon knows very well that it was doing that.
Well, it certainly makes for a very interesting way of trying to examine what is underway. And we haven't even talked about McCarthyism or Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale and so on. But look, I'm sure you've prompted a lot of thinking. Thank you very much indeed for assembling all this and talking to us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Churchwell, who's a professorial fellow in American literature and works at the University of London. And we'll put a link to the Guardian article on our website. We'll also bring you back in the next couple of weeks some of the editors we spoke to in the lead-up, if you remember, with our Election Express, from the states who voted Trump in, to find out how they are reporting the presidency of Donald Trump. We thought that was possibly a very good guide to attitudes within America.